That's Donald Byrd and Pepper Adams with Kuros, recorded in 1961. Donald Byrd on trumpet, of course, is from Detroit. Pepper Adams, also nearby, from Highland Park in Michigan, on baritone sax. Herbie Hancock making his debut, jazz debut, and Layman Jackson on bass, and Jimmy Cobb on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Friday, December the 20th. And we have two issues that we'll be talking about today in Detroit. Vultures are circling around the city's assets. Several of them have already closed bargain basement deals. We'll get updates on that and more in the second half of the program. But first, 20 years after NAFTA, it turns out that Ross Perot was right. It was a giant sucking sound that robbed the U.S. of almost 683,000 jobs. At the first of a series of presidential debates, this one taking place in St. Louis, Missouri in 1992, the candidates were George H.W. Bush, Republican, Democratic challenger Bill Clinton, and Reform Party candidate Ross Perot. The first question asked of Perot was about trade. This is how it went.
And I think the first question is over here.
Yes, I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Perot. What will you do as president to open foreign markets to fair competition from American business and to stop unfair competition here at home from foreign countries so that we can bring jobs back to the United States?
That's right at the top of my agenda. We've shipped millions of jobs overseas. And we have a strange situation because we have a process in Washington where after you've served for a while, you cash in, become a foreign lobbyist, make $30,000 a month, then take a leave, work on presidential campaigns, make sure you got good contacts, and then go back out. Now, if you just want to get down to brass tacks, first thing you ought to do is get all these folks who've got these one-way trade agreements that we've negotiated over the years and say, fellas, we'll take the same deal we gave you. And they'll gridlock right at that point because, for example, we've got international competitors who simply could not unload their cars off the ships if they had to comply. You see, if it was a two-way street, just couldn't do it. We have got to stop sending jobs overseas. To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for labor, hire a young 25, that's assuming you've been in business for a long time, you've got a mature workforce. Pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south. So if the people send me to Washington, the first thing I'll do is study that 2,000-page agreement and make sure it's a two-way street. One last point here. I've decided I was dumb and didn't understand it, so I called a who's who of the folks who've been around it. And I said, why won't everybody go south? They said, we'll be disruptive. I said, for how long? I finally got them up for 12 to 15 years. And I said, well, how does it stop being disruptive? And that is when their jobs come up from $1 an hour to $6 an hour and ours go down to $6 an hour, then it's leveled again. But in the meantime, you've wrecked the country with these kinds of deals. We've got to cut it out.
Thanks.
So, was Ross Perot off, but by only 5 years? Our guest in this first segment of the program is Robert E. Scott. He's the Director of Trade and Manufacturing Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, I read your very comprehensive analysis, and in it you say that because of NAFTA, NAFTA's legacy was a loss of 682,900 jobs. How did you calculate that?
Well, that's based on the kind of method that was used by President Clinton and the economist that he worked with in projecting the benefits of particularly of Mexico joining NAFTA. That's what was new in 1993. Canada and the U.S. already had a free trade agreement. So we focused on this on Mexico, and I simply looked at changes in trade, increases in exports, which support jobs here in the United States, increases in imports, which eliminate jobs here in the United States of workers who used to make those goods. And we take the difference between the two, and that's how we find the number of jobs that have been lost. We do this using economic models from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's how we do the jobs calculus, as it were.
Now, the North America Free Trade Agreement, which is what NAFTA is, spanned four presidents, I should say, from George H.W. Bush to Clinton to George W. Bush to the current president, Barack Obama, conceptualized under the George H.W. Bush administration. What is it about this agreement that all four presidents failed to understand? What were the flaws of NAFTA?
Well, the flaws of NAFTA were that it was an agreement that was tilted in favor of multinational investors, investors from the U.S., from Mexico, and from around the world. All of them have shifted production to Mexico first, and then after 2000, when China joined the World Trade Organization, they've shifted jobs to China as well. It's really been a continuous process of globalization, and it did benefit Wall Street. I am not sure I accept the premise that the presidents didn't know what was going to happen. I think they were getting a lot of pressure from multinational companies to negotiate these deals, which resulted in a tremendous increase in profits and in corporate salaries, but lost jobs and stagnant or falling wages for production workers, not just here in the United States, but in Mexico and Canada as well.
What was the benefit to Mexico in dollars and cents? Has that been calculated? And to Canada in dollars and cents?
There have been lots of studies that have been done. These agreements have relatively small net benefits in terms of their overall impact on growth or GDP. Their biggest impact has been on the distribution of income. Although in each case, the way it's worked has been slightly different. In Mexico, wages for most workers have actually declined relative to those in the United States over the last 20 years. So they have not closed the gap in any way. But again, what has happened is that profits going to the very wealthy have increased enormously. Similarly, in the United States, the average worker here has experienced a loss in 2011 of as much as $1,800 per worker, and that's not just jobs displaced due to trade with Mexico or China. It's all workers who are similar. That is all workers without a college degree, about 100 million in total. In Canada, they've had some of that downward pressure on wages, but they've also seen a tremendous collapse in the social safety net and the government role in the economy. Government spending in Canada has declined by anywhere between 12 and 14 percentage points as a share of GDP, as they've raced to catch up with the small government standards in place in the United States and Mexico.
On January the 1st, NAFTA would be 20 years old, and one would think that, okay, the first term, it didn't work so well, so the economic experts would have deciphered and, you know, torn this agreement apart to find out why didn't it produce the results that it should have based on their calculations and their forecasting. But 20 years is a long time for them not to get a sense that there are some things that are consistently wrong with this agreement. Why hasn't that the time period and all of the studies being done about NAFTA, why hasn't that resulted in a correction or some kind of a reworking of this trade agreement?
Well, I think that in terms of, yes, two questions there really about the, first about the models and why I have an economist appreciated been able to discover what's gone wrong there. I think on that point, I think the economics profession, frankly, has a big set of blinders on when it comes to trade, a belief in any kind of trade liberalization for anyone's benefit, a belief that's good for the economy overall is almost required for membership in the economics profession, and there is a strong prejudice in that direction amongst, particularly amongst academic economists. And in terms of the larger question of why we haven't revised NAFTA to make it work better for working people in throughout North America, I think the answer to that is we know how to do that. We've seen it done in Western Europe, where they brought Greece and Spain and Portugal into the European Union in the 60s and 70s, and they did it by investing in those countries, investing heavily. Tens and hundreds of billions of dollars are spent in those countries to raise education levels and invest in infrastructure and so on. And that's what we need to do in Mexico. It's what we promised to do. We created a North American Development Bank and an environmental bank, but we didn't fund those initiatives. And that's been a big part of the problem. And the bottom line is that we haven't simply been willing to commit the resources needed to make this happen. For many of the same reasons why we're not willing to spend the money needed to end the jobless recession here in the United States. We simply have a bias against government spending in our political system.
But the flaws of NAFTA seem to have gotten new life in other trade agreements, like the Korea Free Trade Agreement and the super secret Trans-Pacific Partnership that the president is negotiating, and nobody knows what's going on in that. So has it not occurred to somebody that if NAFTA, the older version of these free trade agreements or these trade agreements, has such deep flaws that are in fact costing hundreds of thousands of jobs in the United States, chances are that they need to revisit all these major agreements that are on the board.
I think there's no question that we need to go back and renegotiate not just NAFTA, but the U.S.-Korea Free Trade Agreement and agreements with the Central American countries and especially the agreement to bring China into the WTO. Unfortunately, there are very powerful vested interests who would oppose that and who favor more of these kinds of free trade agreements, particularly interests on Wall Street who benefit from these deals. The president has just announced that he's going to make a negotiation of this secret Trans-Pacific Partnership proposal, his number one item on his economic agenda for next year. And in order to make that happen, he's going to very early in the year propose that Congress give him what's called fast track or trade promotion negotiating authority. Authority which would allow the president to bypass Congress and bring these deals forward for a vote without any opportunity for amendment or negotiation on the terms of the accords. For four different administrations now over the past 20 years, both Republican and Democrat, the presidents have seen the promise of free trade deals as a way to make it appear that they are doing something to create jobs in the economy. The reality is they're in fact destroying jobs and putting downward pressure on wages. And I think that that reflects the unequal distribution of political power in our society.
What, therefore, has to happen to enforce the will of outsiders, people who are not in the political system, not part of this, but who understand the really awful impact that these trade agreements have been having on the American economy?
Well, fortunately, there is a growing public outrage on both the left and the right about the consequences of these trade agreements and investment deals. And the presidents of both parties have found it increasingly difficult to obtain this so-called fast-track negotiating authority, which is necessary for them to go out and finalize these kinds of deals with other countries who have also learned that these deals can be very costly and they're very unpopular in many countries around the world because they transfer enormous power to U.S. corporations, special properties to owners of intellectual property right. They create special tribunals where corporations can file suit against governments that are parties to the agreement without recourse to the normal judicial system in any of these countries. So these agreements are being opposed by a growing base of both grassroots liberal and conservative groups, everyone ranging from progressive Democrats to Tea Party Republicans. And just recently, over 170 Democrats sent a letter to the president saying that they don't want to have 20th century fast-track legislation put forward again. They want new restrictions put on the way in which he negotiates trade agreements, particularly to deal with issues like currency manipulation, one of the big issues that hasn't been dealt with, we haven't had a chance to talk about, but it has a big effect on trade. And we had a similar letter that was signed by a large number of Republican members of Congress. So we have a bipartisan coalition that seeks to block this. The last time President Bush obtained fast-track negotiating authority, he only managed to get approved by three votes, and it's been defeated when Bill Clinton asked for it in the late 1990s. So I think there is a strong chance that a coalition of popular forces on the left and the right can come together to block progress towards this very destructive TPP agreement.
Can you think of a free trade agreement that actually serves as a model for what the United States ought to be doing when considering partnering with other countries?
Well, I think that it depends on who you are partnering with to a large degree. The United States has relatively innocuous free trade agreements with countries like Australia. Our agreement with Canada has worked reasonably well, although it has had damaging effects on both countries because of the extension to include Mexico. But if you just step back and look at the U.S.-Canada Free Trade Agreement and its precursors, the automotive agreement, those have worked well. Where we get into trouble is where we try and negotiate these agreements with low-wage countries around the world, and that pits us in a race to the bottom and leads to a rise in offshoring of factories and outsourcing of production and the loss of hundreds of thousands or millions of jobs for U.S. workers.
What should the lesson be here, 20 years down the road from the signing of the North America Free Trade Agreement? What should be next on the agenda?
Well, the first thing to do is to stop negotiating these wantonly destructive trade and investment deals. They have been hurting the economy for, as you say, at least 20 years. And I think we, the physician's first rule is do no more damage. Beyond that, we have to step back and ask, what has gone wrong with the world trading system to lead to these terrible outcomes for workers, both in the U.S. and abroad? And I think, as I mentioned, the first thing we have to do is to address directly the problem of currency manipulation, which about 20 countries around the world are using. It effectively acts as a subsidy to the export of countries like China and Malaysia and Singapore, and a tax on U.S. exports. And so that makes our trade problems and job loss problems worse. And we can end it tomorrow if the president simply uses the tools available at his disposal. Beyond that, we need to tackle unfair trade, and we need to address the global problem of exploitation of labor and the failure to observe fundamental labor rights. And I think we should turn our attention to those issues. Labor rights are in fact human rights that are being abused around the world. And if we can establish a floor for labor rights in the future, then there'll be hope for raising wages in a race to the top rather than a race to the bottom, which we've experienced in the last 20 years.
Thank you, Robert Scott of the Economic Policy Institute, so much. Thank you for your expertise today.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot. Well, we'll go next to Detroit. A little music to make the transition. How about that? It seems that things are going kind of crazy in Detroit, although we hear word that the newly elected mayor, Mayor Duggan, has worked out an agreement with the city's emergency financial manager to share the tasks of running the city, except the mayor would have no pull, really, on the fiscal matters as the city of Detroit goes through its fiscal catharsis, having been permitted by the court to declare bankruptcy on December the 3rd. Abayomi Azikiwe is editor of the Pan-African Newswire and community organizer with the Workers' World Party in Detroit, and he reports on the latest developments in the city. And Abayomi, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what's been going on in your wonderful city?
A lot has been going on. As you mentioned, on December 3rd, federal judge Stephen Rhodes ruled that the city of Detroit, meaning Jones Day Law Firm and the governor and the emergency manager, were eligible for filing Chapter 9 bankruptcy. In his ruling, he stated very clearly that those entities who now say they represent the city of Detroit did not negotiate in good faith. However, he said that because Detroit had approximately 100,000 creditors, then it was impractical to negotiate in good faith. So therefore, that would not be an impediment for saying that the city was eligible for bankruptcy. Another key aspect of his ruling is that the pensions, which are guaranteed one of the strongest guarantees in the country within the state constitution, can be diminished, according to the ruling of Judge Stephen Rhodes. Now, he also has given the go-ahead for the appeal with the Sixth Circuit Court, and that is significant. So there are people involved in the case who are appealing at this point. Currently, there is a series of hearings that are being held as part of a trial over whether or not Barclays Bank will loan Detroit $350 million. in order to pay off UBS, United Bank of Switzerland, and the Bank of America. And we have been opposing this through the Moratorium Now Coalition. An attorney that works with us is heavily involved in this case. And there was a hearing that was held on the first day of the trial, December the 17th. And then on the next day, December 18th, the judge adjourned the trial, saying that the conditions for the loan were not favorable. Well, many people knew that. The entire city council voted against it. It was a unanimous vote against the Barclays deal. There are many community organizations, including Moratorium Now and others, who are opposed to the deal. So now they're at the point where they claim they're working out some type of arrangement to terminate these swaps, which came out of a 2005 deal that was actually hailed by the local corporate media. It was championed even by Wall Street. The former mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, was awarded for going along with this interest rate swap scheme. However, at its current juncture, it's something that could cripple at least 20% of the city's income tax revenue and possibly 20% of the casino tax revenue over the next 6 to 8 years. So this is what's going on right now, and we are following this situation very, very closely.
But, you know, Abayomi, I got to say about Judge Rhodes, he seems to be sending some mixed signals. Why doesn't, and this was a central question, why not have these issues, the base issues, resolved first before even starting a trial? Even though they began the trial on the 17th and then suspended the trial and it starts again today, but why not, you know, get certain things resolved? For example, he ruled that the city is eligible for bankruptcy and then came back and said, but it can be appealed because it is not clear that the city negotiated with its creditors in good faith. Now, logic would say that should have been determined first, you know, and then you have a trial. What do you read into this?
Well, we can only speculate. We know that there's a tremendous amount of pressure on Judge Rhodes by the banks, by the corporations, and their allies in the governor's office and other venues, not only in Detroit, but throughout the country and indeed the world. So there's a lot at stake in this whole bankruptcy process. He's also under a lot of pressure from the unions, from community organizations, from the pension trustees board and others, the overall public opinion in the city of Detroit and even in the state of Michigan is against these procedures. They're against emergency management, and most people were against the filing of the bankruptcy. What people need to know around the country, and I always repeat this, is that it was not the city of Detroit that filed bankruptcy. The whole filing process in and of itself was illegal because it was not the elected officials of the city of Detroit who filed for the bankruptcy. It was the imposed emergency manager working on behalf of the governor, Rick Snyder, who in fact is working on behalf of the corporations and the banks and the bondholders and the bond insurers. The majority of the people in the state of Michigan 13 months ago voted against emergency management by a wide margin. So they went and changed the law during the lame duck session, linked it with an appropriations bill so it cannot be challenged through referendum as it was during 2012. And that's how we wound up with Public Act 436, which is the new emergency manager or dictator law, as it is called on the streets in Detroit and the streets of other cities throughout Michigan. So this whole process, according to many people, is illegal. There were 110 citizens, residents of the city of Detroit, who filed objections to the bankruptcy. There was an objections hearing that lasted all day. Over 50 people testified, and these were not all lawyers. Most of them were city workers, retirees, community workers, and the judge listened to all that testimony, and in regard to his ruling, it was completely ignored. So I think he's responding to the pressures that are coming down on him from both the banks, the corporations, and the governor's office and the emergency manager's office. But at the same time, there's political consequences to all of these issues. It potentially, this can set a very dangerous precedent for the sanctity of pension funds across the country, public assets, just the whole notion of democracy, political or bourgeois democracy, as it is often called, has essentially been diminished or abolished in the city of Detroit and other municipalities around the state of Michigan. So these are some of the dynamics that are going on, but I don't trust the process. Watching the eligibility trial gave us a clear indication that it appears that the court is weighted in favor of the banks and in favor of emergency management and the whole restructuring of not only the pension systems, but the entire way in which a municipality is operating and has operated in the United States.
In the meantime, though, vultures are circling around the city's assets, and some of them have managed to score bargain basement deals. Could you give us some examples of what has been going on in that regard?
Yeah, they just did an appraisal of the artwork at the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is outrageous. Our position is that all of the city-owned assets belong to the residents of the city of Detroit. They should not be put up for sale. There should not even be an appraisal of these assets because the appraisal is being driven by those who want to seize and sell off the assets of the Detroit Institute of Arts. So there's also artwork as well in the main branch of the Detroit Public Library. There have been efforts to try to do an appraisal of the artwork there as well. Belle Isle, they've already passed legislation on the state level to turn Belle Isle, which is a huge island, a public park between Detroit and Canada, a very beautiful piece of land. You have deer out there and other wild animals, and it used to be open 24 hours a day. Now they close at about 10 p.m., but they turned Belle Isle into a state park, and they have ideas about charging people an annual fee for access to the island and other commercial ventures that are planned for the island. Now, this is a plan that was turned down by the city council. They came up with an alternative plan, which has been totally disregarded by the governor and the state legislature. But those are two examples. Also, they're looking at ways in which to privatize and also lessen the administrative control by the city of Detroit of the Detroit Water and Sewage Department, one of the largest water systems in the United States, very efficiently run, generates hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue annually, and is worth billions upon billions of dollars. That, too, is owned by the city of Detroit. They're looking at ways in which they can privatize the Detroit Water and Sewage Department as well. So these are some of the examples. Public lighting, they already have passed legislation to set up a public lighting authority in order to turn that over possibly in regard to its operation to DTE Energy, one of the largest utility companies in the state of Michigan, a multi-billion-dollar company. They claim to be worth more than $22, $23 billion. So all of this is designed to further enrich those who have, in fact, created the conditions for the financial ruin of the city of Detroit.
But you have a nice hockey stadium, a hockey facility, and you have lovely stadiums that are going up, and people are getting lovely breaks. I mean, even
yeah, isn't that amazing?
The owner of PayPal, not PayPal, the owner of
Quicken Loans.
Quicken Loans is now mapping every single block of your city to decide what ought to be done with each of these available parcels.
Yeah, that too is outrageous because Dan Gilbert is someone who does not have a good reputation in regard to how he treats his employees. He's been given almost 20 buildings in downtown Detroit, buildings that were in receivership. And now he's been appointed to this blight authority where they're going to, as you said, track every parcel of land and every building occupied or unoccupied in the city of Detroit to determine what should stand, what should be obliterated, and what should be reformed or refurbished. And I think that's a very dangerous situation because they can use this as a mechanism of forcing even more people out of the city because of the economic crisis that exists in the city. Many people cannot afford to maintain their property in a way in which it should be maintained. And therefore, if you have private entities that can designate a building, a residential building, or a commercial facility as being blighted, then that places that facility, that property, in imminent danger. That means that they could authorize it to either be put in, to be condemned, or either to be in a situation where it can be raised. And this is a very dangerous situation. And you mentioned the new plans for a hockey stadium. The hockey team is owned by Mike Ilitch. He's a pizza magnet in the city of Detroit. He's part of the Nouveau Riche in this area. And he also owns the Detroit Tigers. He owns Comerica Park, where the Tigers play. And now they're going to construct this huge $600 million hockey arena, moving from one location downtown to another location downtown. And tens of millions of that dollars, of those dollars, are going to be supplied by the tax revenue of the city of Detroit. That's going to build the principal infrastructure, the sidewalks, the piping, the lighting facilities. All of that is going to be paid for by residents of the city of Detroit through the Downtown Development Authority, which captures tax revenue that should be going to the libraries, the public schools, and other publicly owned entities in the city of Detroit. So you see the contradiction in regard to what's going on. On the one hand, they're saying the city is insolvent, but then on the other hand, they're building a huge new hockey arena. And this hockey arena is not going to employ a lot of people. In its construction, it wouldn't employ a lot of people. That's only temporary work. And then the hockey games are not played all year round. And people who work as concessionaires and custodial workers, they don't get paid a lot of money for working for these major professional sports arenas. So it's just another form of exploitation in regard to the people of the city of Detroit.
The organization that you are an organizer with, Moratorium Now, which seeks to put a hold on evictions and utility cutoffs for people who are having an extremely hard time during the fiscal crisis, or the alleged fiscal crisis, I should say, what's happening with the people that you've been advocating for?
Well, people are still being put out of their homes. It's a two-pronged strategy that they have. Detroit had one of the highest home ownership rates in the United States. Now that has fallen substantially. A lot of people now are forced to rent apartments and homes. But a lot of people, for various reasons, have huge tax bills. And after 2 years, they are forced into foreclosure if they can't come up with the back taxes or work out a payment plan with the Wayne County government, which collects taxes for the city of Detroit. The city of Detroit now is not the ultimate collector in regard to tax. That's property tax revenue. But at the same time, it's been reported even in the corporate media that people like Mike Ilitch owes tens of millions of dollars in back taxes on properties that they have downtown, and they're not being forced, and they're not being restrained from engaging in other types of economic activity. So, you know, there's a double standard that's in operation here. So people are still losing their homes. They're still being evicted for various reasons in the downtown area and in the midtown area where they're heavily gentrifying. They're just moving people out. Senior citizens, people on fixed incomes are being ordered to move, and they want to bring in a higher income group to occupy those buildings in downtown Detroit. So this is what's going on. And what's also egregious about this whole process is that now the government agencies, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, have bought up a lot of the foreclosed properties in Detroit and in other areas around the country. So they are doing most of the foreclosures now in Detroit. So we have a governmental entity that has become the major source for eviction and foreclosure in the city of Detroit and in other cities around the country. And this is something the Obama administration could address directly. He could impose a federal moratorium on all HUD and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac properties around the country. But he has chosen not to do so, even though he's been pressured to do so now for well over 3 years by our organization and by other anti-foreclosure organizations operating around the country.
Looking ahead, we have only, let's say, one more week left to bring us to the end of the year and the start of a new one. What's ahead in the immediate future for Detroit?
Well, it depends to the degree to which we can organize and mobilize people to oppose these cuts that are coming in the pensions, further downsizing of the city. That's going to be the determining factor in this whole process. The 1%, they have their own agenda, and their agenda is the theft of pension funds, the busting of unions, the seizure of public assets, and to set a national pattern to enforce these new policies. It's quite clear to them. They have a low-wage capitalist economy, and that low-wage economy is going to expand. And that's why we are very encouraged by the strikes and demonstrations that have been taking place across the country in the fast food industry and at other service corporations, who, in fact, are paying their workers starvation wages, many of whom are eligible for public benefits like food stamps and other types of social service assistance. And we think it's very positive that this movement is rising up, and we think it's a movement that should be an alliance and is inherently an alliance with the movement to stop the theft of pensions, and the movement to further privatize the operations of municipalities around the United States. So we see that as being positive. The efforts that we've engaged in here in the city of Detroit, although we have not been able to stop the bankruptcy, we have been able to expose locally, statewide, nationally, and internationally, the true character of this whole bankruptcy process and what's in store for cities throughout the United States. So that's what I see going forward in 2014. It's going to be a lot more hard work to engage in, but I think it's worthwhile to carry out this organizing project because eventually people around the country are going to realize that the cities, even though they are different, they have more in common than they have not in common. So I think that this is a challenge that we're going to face for 2014 and years to come after 2014.
I have to ask about leadership. I placed several calls to Congressman Conyers' office and have not had the calls returned. Is there a sense, is there a visible presence of political leadership on this question, the whole issue about this positioning of Detroit to compel it to fail in order to achieve other agendas? Is there a sense that the political leadership is responding adequately to the crisis that has been created?
Not at all. They've been largely absent, with the exception of possibly one or two people. No, they have, in essence, hidden or ran the other way in this whole process. I don't think they know how to respond. That's one problem. Another issue is that they would have to effectively challenge the Obama administration, and many of them are Democrats, and they don't want to challenge the Obama administration. So this is a serious problem because the Obama administration had submitted a brief during the eligibility trial saying that the process was constitutional. Now, this was done despite the fact that many leading Democratic Party politicians and others had written a letter to Eric Holder, the U.S. Attorney General, over a year ago, asking for his intervention in combating the emergency manager law based upon the fact that it curbs the right to vote for over half of the African-American population in the state of Michigan. And as far as I know, there was no response to their letter by the Attorney General's office. So it's really a profound contradiction that here you have an African-American, largely African-American city that's represented by numerous African-American political officials, yet they have not come to the fore to battle this illegal usurpation of power, disenfranchisement of hundreds of thousands of African-Americans in Detroit, and more around the state. So I think the political leadership has really failed the city of Detroit and other cities in the state of Michigan.
For yourself, I mean, you're a Detroiter. What is the sentiment of Detroiters about this situation? How do they feel about the city now?
A lot of people are angry. Then a lot of people are also demoralized because the regular channels of dissent and opposition are no longer operable. As I mentioned, people were against emergency management. They voted against it, and it was imposed anyway against their will. People were against the appointment of an emergency manager, and it was done anyway. People were not in favor of the filing of bankruptcy, and it was done anyway. So people are angry that their rights are being violated, but at the same time, a lot of people are feeling that the system does not work for them, and they're trying to figure out other ways of demonstrating their resistance and their opposition. We know that the political structures in society are largely determined, the character largely determined by the economic relations of production. We have a capitalist economy now that's in deep crisis, irrespective of what the administration says or what the corporate media says. There are no real jobs that are being created. Wages are going down. Poverty is going up. Unemployment is still extremely high, particularly in the African-American, Latino communities. So the old methods of conducting political business are not functioning at this point. So we have to come up with new methods. And that's why we have to seize upon the role of the banks, the role of the corporations, and the destruction of the cities. And there has to be an independent political movement built around these issues. I see no other alternative. We cannot rely on the Democratic Party or the Republican Party politicians because, unfortunately, many of them are in the back pockets of these same entities that have been implicated in the destruction of the city of Detroit and other municipalities around the country.
Abba Yomi, I want to thank you so much for your always enlightening analyses of what's going on at ground level in your beloved city of Detroit. Thank you so much. How can people
thank you for
access
your continued interest, and I really appreciate having the opportunity of getting this information out to people all over the country and indeed all over the world.
Well, you know you are our official correspondent in Detroit.
Well, that's great to know.
Thank you so much. And we'll talk again soon. following
okay,
up
you
on
so
your
much.
City. Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I hope we learned a couple of things about NAFTA and most free trade or so-called free trade agreements worked out by the United States. The lesson there, whether Republican or Democrat, it made no difference. The trade agreements consistently have harmed the United States. And for whatever reason, they proceed. If a thing doesn't work, they try and try again with something new. So we will be following up on that because, of course, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is next, and it's going to be a huge fight. So I want to thank Robert Scott of the Economic Policy Institute for bringing that explanation to us about free trade agreements, and absolutely thanking Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, for bringing us up to snuff with what's going on in Detroit, which we will be following. This is a very, very important story because it is the test case for many other major urban centers, and it's basically the taking of Detroit unfolding before our very eyes. Have a good weekend. We'll see each other on Monday. You can always reach me at leadstories, L-E-I-D, stories@gmail.com, or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. Stay tuned right here. Coming up next, Occupied Territory, America with Mike Fader. Bye-bye.